Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the assassination of the president of Haiti, Jovenel Moïse, who was gunned down along with his wife, who was wounded, in his residence by a hit team apparently posing as DEA agents. Joining us to discuss the volatile situation in Haiti is Haitian-born Alex Dupuis, who is Professor of Sociology Emeritus at Wesleyan University and the author of The Prophet and Power, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, The International Community and Haiti, and Haiti, From Revolutionary Slaves to Powerless Citizens, whose latest book is Rethinking the Haitian Revolution, Slavery, Independence, and the Struggle for Recognition. We will discuss how Moïse was both increasingly authoritarian and increasingly unpopular, having overstayed his welcome after his term had expired in February, along with having purged the Supreme Court and proposed a referendum that would keep him in power until 2032. Yet Moïse had support from the OAS, and Trump liked him because he was a strongman thug, and the State Department continued to support him in spite of worsening economic and security conditions in the country. Then we look further into the turmoil in Haiti and speak with a longtime observer of Haiti, Amy Wilentz, an award-winning writer of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now, whose latest book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She joins us to discuss her article at The Nation, published just one day before the assassination, Haiti Has Been Abandoned by the Media, the U.S., and the World, and how gangs and a new corrupt elite have made the country unlivable for the already desperately poor Haitians. Then finally, we will speak with Amanda Tyler, the Executive Director of Christians Against Christian Nationalism, about a religious movement underway in the country that was propelled by the January 6th storming of the Capitol, in which Christian symbols were mixed with white supremacist signs and Confederate flags. She joins us to discuss a new curriculum launched on July the 6th to help Christian leaders discuss with fellow believers the heresy and dangers of Christian nationalism. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Alex Dupuis, who is a professor of sociology emeritus at Wesleyan University, who has published broadly on social, economic, and political developments in Haiti and the Caribbean. He's the author of Haiti in the World Economy, Class, Race, and Underdevelopment Since 1700, Haiti in the New World Order, The Limits of Democratic Revolution, The Prophet and Power, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, The International Community in Haiti, and Haiti, From Revolutionary Slaves to Powerless Citizens. And his latest book is Rethinking the Haitian Revolution, Slavery, Independence, and the Struggle for Recognition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Dupuis.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And there's been this assassination of the President Moïse, who'd overstayed his welcome, and people were very unhappy about it. The streets are deserted now. They've been very consistent demonstrations against him. But I guess the most mysterious part of this assassination is that the assassins appear to be highly disciplined, posing as drug enforcement agents, speaking Spanish and English, according to the successor, Mr. Joseph, of Moïse. So let's focus on that. What are you hearing, Alex, in terms of who might have been behind this? Because my assumption would be that Moïse, even though he's in his own private residence, he had to have a lot of protection because he's very unpopular, right, and he travels around with a tremendous amount of bodyguards. So
Right.
What do you know about the people that killed him and how they were able to manage to do it?
Well, right now I don't have an answer for that because it's not exactly clear who actually carried out the raid on his house. Read in some parts that it was a commando, but it wasn't specified what the commando was or who was leading it and where they came from. It's unknown at this point who could have carried it out. Obviously, as you said, they had to breach the security to have access to him in his house. So that could raise a question as to whether there was some complicity with the security forces, but that would be clearly speculation on my part because I don't have any evidence for that. But you're right that there would have had to be some security protecting him at his house, and that they could enter raises some serious questions about that security. That's all I can say at this point because it's not clear who carried it out. Now, Moise was, at odds with some of the gangs in Port-au-Prince who have been wreaking havoc lately by gang killings and displacing thousands of people from the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. Making them homeless and so on, and engaging in warfare amongst themselves. So Moise was trying to control that situation, but obviously had not fully succeeded in doing so. So whether the assassination is connected to some of the gangs, again, hopefully we will know more detail as time goes by. So I can't give you a precise answer about what gang or who actually was involved in the assassination.
Well, of course, none of that information has come out yet via the press.
Right.
Back in December, the Treasury Department sanctioned two of Moise's administration officials under the Global Magnitsky Act. They were implicated in the La Saline massacre in which Moise used his own street gangs. So is that what's been going on? You've had government control street gangs versus other street gangs?
Well, there was some of that going on, and there was a threat of warfare among the gang leaders if that continued. And so there was, again, some speculation that Moise was controlling some of the gangs. None of that has been fully laid out very clearly so that we know who was acting against whom. So it's until we get more clear and verifiable information about all that, it's hard to speculate, except to say that Moise certainly had his enemies in Haiti, and compounded by the fact that he was refusing to call for new elections. He was contemplating amending the constitution to change the bicameral parliament into one chamber, and to amend the constitution to allow for more than a five-year term as president, but none of that materialized. But that he had opposition in Haiti and even enemies is very clear.
Well, as I mentioned, he'd overstayed his welcome. His term ended in February, but he stayed on, and then he came up with this plan to reshuffle power, essentially granting enormous amounts of power to himself.
Absolutely.
Through to what? 2032.
Yeah. It wasn't clear what he had in mind, but he wanted to certainly amend the constitution to allow for a longer term as a single term as president. But that never materialized, obviously, and there was strong opposition to that in Haiti. But the opposition also itself is not very well organized and they have factions that are at odds with each other. So, and Moïse basically was thought at any rate that he could go it alone because Parliament, he's been ruling by decree since last year, so because Parliament was never renewed.
And now he has his protege, Claude Joseph, the interim prime minister,
correct,
in charge. But
right,
he's not exactly a credible figure either, is he?
Well, I mean, he has no legitimacy because the government itself had lost its constitutional legitimacy. But right now, he's the only one in charge, and it remains to be seen what he'll be able to do, if anything, to change the situation and calm things down, and at least move towards organizing new elections for both the parliament and the president. But it also depends on whether the opposition parties, groups such as they are, can get their act together among themselves to push for new elections at both the presidential and parliamentary levels. But that remains to be seen. But right now, things are, as you can imagine, probably pretty much in chaos in Haiti.
And again, I'm speaking with Alex Dupuis, who's a professor of sociology emeritus at Wesleyan University, who has published broadly on social, economic, and political developments in Haiti and the Caribbean. He's the author of Haiti in the World Economy, Class, Race, and Underdevelopment Since 1700, Haiti in the New World Order, The Limits of Democratic Revolution, The Profit and Power, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, The International Community and Haiti. And his latest book is Rethinking the Haitian Revolution, Slavery, Independence, and the Struggle for Recognition. So, I mean, for the longest time, Alex, there have been demonstrations every Sunday against Moïse. The people are obviously fed up with him and the corruption, and
right,
things have
right,
gotten worse. Prices have gone up. Violence
right,
has increased. Kidnapping is rampant.
Right.
Even poor people are being kidnapped all
correct,
over the place.
Correct.
So, you see, when the people demonstrate, they hold up signs, you know. In fact, they demonstrate in front of the U.S. Embassy. They're saying to the Americans, you know, help us out. And the American ambassador is there, along with another American diplomat who's the U.N. representative in Haiti as well. So what is going on with the United States? I mean, I don't understand why they want to keep these corrupt people in power. And it goes way back to Papa Doc. But what is it about the U.S.? I mean, it's not as if the U.S. should have toppled this guy, but the U.S. should never have propped him up.
Well, that is a great question. But from this, given the history of the U.S. In Haiti since its occupation from 1915 to 1934, the U.S. Has sought to maintain the status quo, by which I mean maintain the current, whatever governments come to power, with the exception of the Duvalier initially when there was opposition to him. But there was never any attempt to remove him from power, because as long as the governments in Haiti remain open to so-called do business, as it's been some U.S. and other authorities have called that, Haiti remains open for business and continues to not create trouble for U.S. investors or for the U.S. In Haiti or in the Caribbean, then they have sought to collaborate or to maintain these governments, whether elected or not, in power. And you can go back to what the U.S. did with Aristide when they opposed the policies that he had been suggesting that he had wanted to put in place that were inimical to U.S. interests. And they collaborated to have him removed from power. When he went back, when Clinton brought him back to Haiti in 1994, Aristide then agreed to the demands of the U.S. to lower tariffs rice, to lower rice imports to the lowest level in the Caribbean, to the point where now Haiti imports, a significant percentage of its rice from the U.S. when it used to be self-sufficient in rice production. And a similar other policies with the assembly industries and the lower wages of Haitians, allowing plantations to be removing peasants from their land to establish these assembly industries in the northern part of Haiti and so on. So as long as whoever is in power was willing to maintain the status quo, then the U.S. sought to collaborate or support them. So, as you know, there was also a long UN-sponsored intervention that lasted in Haiti for a long time after Aristide was removed from power. So it's basically making sure that Haiti does not become a trouble spot in the Caribbean and continues to follow U.S. interests and U.S. dictates. That's been the policy, and it hasn't changed, regardless of whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration.
Well, I recall how the U.S. went after Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the priest.
Yes, the former priest.
As though he was former priest, as though he was, this sort of Marxist firebrand.
Right.
So we understand the paranoia that the U.S. has about having another Cuba in the hemisphere now that they've also got Venezuela. So that's their perennial paranoia. But on the other hand, when you have corrupt leaders like Moise, you end up with drug trafficking, et cetera. So
I don't
understand the trade-off. And nobody in the Haitian opposition that I know of wants to turn the country into another Cuba, do they? They just want democracy.
No, that is not in the cards. That is not in the cards. Well, basically what you have is competing elites in Haiti who want to have access to the presidency and the benefits and so on. The fruits of holding power in Haiti have always been lucrative for those who held power. So as you can go back to Moise, the example of allegedly absconding Caribbean funds that he was alleged to have siphoned. And so the long history of Haiti is that whoever is in power uses that power for self-enrichment and the people, the minions they have amongst them. So whether democratically elected or not, whoever has come to power has followed that tradition. And despite the call by many in the opposition for more honest and accountable government and so on, that has never been the case in Haiti. And Moise was another example of that, because he didn't want to abide by the constitutional mandate of the 5-year term in power. So he was seeking to amend it to change that to his liking. And unfortunately, there is not a well-organized and strong, determined opposition to propose a serious alternative other than having more elections. But unless the structures of Haiti are reformed to make it possible for more people to participate, not only in the political process, but the economy, the situation is not going to change anytime soon. So it doesn't.
And on top of that, of course, I was going to say, on top of that, Alex, you don't have the judiciary has been destroyed by Moise.
Correct.
He fired the Supreme Court justices, and the right. Supreme Court Chief Justice just died of COVID.
Right. So, correct, and that's been the tradition. You have a very 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 weak judiciary system that has virtually no power to check on the ambitions and the predatory practices of those in power, And it's been that's been the political tradition in Haiti for a very long time, ever since before and after the U.S. occupation. That hasn't changed, and as long as I said before, whoever is in power continues to be quote unquote open for business to make sure that Haiti does not shut its door to offering the cheapest wages in the region to foreign investors and continue to abide by the dictates of the U.S. and then they'll keep them in power. So there's not much interest in having Haiti become a more fully democratic society, because a more fully democratic society might begin to challenge the status quo in Haiti, which the 2% of the population who appropriate more than 50% of the national income are quite satisfied also with the status quo. So it's not only those in power, but those who have investment interests, business interests, who are the ruling class of Haiti, who don't want necessarily also to have a significant change in the way business is done.
Well, Alex Dupuy, I thank you very much for joining us here today, and we'll stay tuned. Obviously, there's not a lot of clarity about certainly who did this,
Right.
and it does seem very suspicious that, of course, the successor, Claude Joseph, who's now the interim prime minister, said it was done by foreigners speaking English and Spanish. So that's kind of ominous. So
Well, that's
we'll
yeah,
stay
we
tuned.
don't yeah, we don't know we don't know how true that is, but we won't know until a full investigation is done and some more facts are established.
Right.
Right.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, Alex Dupuy.
You're quite welcome. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Alex Dupuy, who's a professor of sociology emeritus at Wesleyan University, who's published broadly on social, economic, and political developments in Haiti and the Caribbean. He's the author of Haiti in the New World Order, The Limits of Democratic Revolution, The Profit and Power, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, The International Community and Haiti, and Haiti from Revolutionary Slaves to Powerless Citizens. And his latest book is Rethinking the Haitian Revolution, Slavery, Independence, and the Struggle for Recognition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the turmoil in Haiti and how gangs and a new corrupt elite have made the country unlivable for the already desperately poor Haitians. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amy Willens, who's an award-winning writer whose books include The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. Awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in General Nonfiction in 2020, she is the former Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker, a longtime contributing editor at The Nation, and she teaches at the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. And her latest book is Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti, and she has an article at The Nation. Haiti has been abandoned by the media, the U.S., and the world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amy Willens.
Thank you.
So, Amy, you posted your article, less than 24 hours before we now learned that the president of Haiti, who has overstayed his welcome, Moise, has been assassinated?
Yeah, I did. I'm a little in shock right now because, of course, my article was not very positive about him, and as it rightly so, and now he's gone. So I'm feeling the vacuum myself.
Well, but does that mean that the country that's been abandoned will suddenly have attention, but will it be helpful attention?
Well, the country that's been abandoned is the country. The United States has just said, okay, Moise is there. He was elected. Trump liked him because he was a strong man. Biden liked him because he was an elected president. So they just sort of stopped thinking seriously about Haiti and went on hoping that somehow Moise would preside over good elections, even though the country is in chaos and nobody even wants to go out on the street to buy groceries, much less to go to a voting place. So now that's gone. That mirage is gone for them, and that it's sort of the curtain to hide behind that Moi has provided is gone. What will they do now? I think it depends largely on what emerges in the wake of this assassination.
Well, Moïse, though, appears to have, your article talks a lot about the kidnapping of just about anybody, rich or poor, and how much the gangs have taken over huge neighborhoods. But it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Moïse himself had relationships with gangs, if not control of gangs, because of the La Saline massacre, which is clearly he was implicated in, because in December, the Treasury Department imposed the Global Magnitsky Act sanctions on two former Moïse administration officials implicated in the La Saline massacre.
Yes, this is true. The La Saline massacre, which is now more than a year ago, in which more than 70 people were killed, was a gang action. And it is true that Moïse politicians, in fact, who supported Moïse were involved in that. I think Moïse was up to his neck with the gangs. The gangs were part of the way to run Haiti, not for the people of Haiti, but for the drug traffickers and other criminal families that are exploiting Haiti and profiting from lawlessness as well as from graft. And I think what we've seen now is that when you run a country like that and gangs and mobsters are the way you run it, sometimes you get caught too.
But your article talks about human rights activist Antoinette Duclair, 33, and her friend and colleague Diego Charles, 33, who's a journalist for Radio Television 2000. They were assassinated in Port-au-Prince by killers who haven't been captured. She was shot in the head twice and in the chest several more times. So is Moïse behind that, do you think? Was he?
I now think perhaps he was, but more likely it was the same people who killed him who killed her. But that's pure errant speculation. My friends in Haiti are seeing her assassination now as a warning to opposition leaders that the threat is very serious. I mean, they already felt that when she was killed, but when the president is killed, you know that the people who are roaming your streets are capable of anything. So they're, you know, it's a bit stifling for the opposition right now. Plus, they are not sure who they're opposing.
But the assassins, as far as we know, and this information comes from the interim prime minister, who's a crony of Moïse's, that they were English and Spanish speaking. They were dressed as DEA agents. It's extraordinary to think that they could take over the compound because Moïse had a lot of bodyguards, didn't he? He understood he was not popular. So I guess there's not much information coming in on that to verify not who these people were and the notion that they may have been imposters pretending to be DEA agents speaking Spanish and English.
I think they were imposters because it's very hard for me. I watched the video. It's at night, of course, so there's a huge amount of gunfire, and then you hear a voice say, "This is DEA operation, stand down." And I don't believe the DEA when it goes in. It announces that it's a DEA operation, stand down. Maybe. No, I think this was a hit squad hired by someone with a lot of money and a lot of planning to go in there. Maybe one person in Moïse's security team was flipped. I don't know how it happened, but the neighborhood was watching with their cell phones, and there's video footage on Twitter somewhere of it.
But given that the U.S. government, for reasons which I'm absolutely mystified by, have always resisted any reform in that country and have supported the worst kind of leadership, including Moïse and his predecessor. So it's always been mystifying why the U.S. is so opposed to democracy. Now, you might argue, of course, they're terrified of another Cuba, but nobody in the opposition, as far as I can tell, even have whiffs of that. And Aristide, the former priest who was a bugaboo to Washington, he was hardly a raving Marxist. So do you think this is a wake-up call for Biden? I mean, he's supporting the guy that Trump supported because he liked the fact that he was a thug and a strong man. So Do you expect anything from Biden?
It's hard to say, you know. Certainly his attitude toward Moise has not inspired confidence in his dedication to, you know, popular participation in governance. I think what the US has always desired, as I wrote in my Nation piece, is stability. Stability is the watchword, and they thought that they could get stability through what were termed democratic elections, but most of the elections in Haiti, with the possible exception of Aristide's election, were not democratic, but were really, as many have said, selections, not elections. And the selections were made by largely by the international community. That was also the case with Moise, whose election was green lighted or rubber stamped by the OAS Commission on the election, even though it was a very undemocratic election and highly contested. So I can't say that I expect a lot from Biden, but it does depend what emerges. I fear what will emerge is a strong man who will say, you know what? Elections are a great idea. I really support the idea of elections, but we can't have them now. The country is in too much turmoil. You know, we'll see what kind of a strong man that is. But maybe an interim government will come into power that will hold elections and will be run by the opposition. I highly doubt it.
And again, I'm speaking with Amy Wilentz, who's an award-winning writer whose books include The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She was awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship in General Nonfiction in 2020 and is the former Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker and a longtime contributing editor at The Nation. And she teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. And her latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And she has an article at The Nation, Haiti Has Been Abandoned by the Media, the U.S., and the World. So as dysfunctional and counterintuitive the U.S. foreign policy has been towards Haiti, it's almost, you could describe it as kind of a zombie foreign policy, because it doesn't matter who's in power, they keep the same kind of policies intact. The OAS, though, according to your article, is even worse in many ways. Why are they supporting this untenable status quo?
Well, there's a lot of dissension inside the OAS about Haiti, but so far the people who have come to Haiti on missions for the OAS and also the OAS advisors on Haiti over the years have supported Moise. I think, you know, my only belief is that it must be because among a rogues gallery, he's one they know how to talk to. But, you know, Haiti policy has been influenced for years by the business community in Haiti. And with advisors like that, you don't really need to look farther for bad advice because they're just protecting their own fiefdoms.
Well, but one of the things that appears to have been motivating U.S. foreign policy is the fact that the business community like the idea of cheap labor, and they want the stability that enables these factories to employ incredibly cheap labor. But my understanding is now, because of the gang violence, that there isn't that stability anymore. So that argument seems to have gone by the wayside.
Well, it's not normal business anymore. It's mafia business. It's stealing money at the port. It's stealing money at the airport. It's levying your own personal taxes on imports and exports. It's big criminal business now, and that is what the families are into. I hate to sound like I'm talking about The Godfather instead of Haiti, but it is like that. And so there's so much on the line, and stability is bad for that kind of business. What you want is instability, lack of law and order. It's not like, you know, the businessman with the offshore factory exploiting the cheap labor. It's nothing like that. Those people are all struggling. You know, we're supposed to now have sympathy for them because this thing is worse.
Well, there's always been this corrupt elite, hasn't there? So, but there's also the foreign businessmen. So the foreign businessmen are no longer, they're pulling out. So is the corrupt elite, is that who you're fingering here?
No, not exactly, because when you say the corrupt elite, I think you're talking about the light-skinned, cultural, morally repugnant elite Haitians of, you know, 10 generations in the, you know, since the revolution, reactionary, et cetera. That's not who's doing this now. These are newer families who came to Haiti to do business, maybe, I don't know, many generations ago, like two or three generations ago, and have kind of gotten a grip on these various sectors of the economy. I think it's the elite that's astonished and feeling out of power now and eclipsed by this new economic elite that is willing to do any kind of business. Not that the old elite wasn't willing to do that, but there's now a new, more international elite that is running things.
And they, I imagine, since they're criminally inclined, are they in the drug trade as well? Or are they enabling the drug trade?
I believe so. I believe so much of this is about drug trafficking through Haiti, and Haiti as a interim step in drug trafficking in the region.
So in terms of internal deliberations going on with the Biden administration, are the DEA lobbying against the State Department's peculiar zombie-like foreign policy, which is the way I describe it? I mean, the demonstrations that have been going on every Sunday have been in front of the U.S. Embassy. And it, as it happens, the top U.N. representative there is also a former American diplomat. So the people seem to be wanting, on the one hand, America to help them out, on the other hand, blaming America.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good combination, isn't it? It is, I would say, largely a historical fact that the U.S. is responsible for much of the dysfunction in Haitian governance since the occupation and onward under Duvalier. The state has never functioned for the nation. When it has tried to do so, it has been summarily dumped by the United States, as in the Aristide years. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's logical for them to both wish that the United States would be on the right side and to point the finger at the United States.
But just in the last couple of minutes, just to touch on
the last
what kind of influence does the DEA have? I mean, they're trying to stop drugs coming into the country, and this political dysfunction and these corrupt governments that are enabling this trafficking and this whole new elite of crooked people that have taken over from the formerly morally repugnant elite. You'd think that the United States would want to get better governance to stop the drug trade.
Well, we've tried occasionally to stop the drug trade, and we've put some people in jail who are operating in the Haitian drug trade. But I think it's a big group, and there's a reason why these guys said they were the DEA. It seemed logical that they might be. But I mean, there are possibly better people to interview about the DEA than I am, who I'm just a Haitian expert, not a DEA expert or a U.S. government expert.
Well, I was thinking just in terms of countervailing forces sitting around the Situation Room in the White House, arguing for better governance, since we do seem to have this zombie policy and that Biden is not really deviating from Trump's policy.
Well, give Biden a day, you know?
Exactly.
Give one day to react. I'm having trouble. I'm sure he's having trouble.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I certainly don't mean to dump on him, but
let's adopt a slight wait and see policy. But you know, they don't know what's going to emerge from this yet either. I'm sure they have better intelligence than I do, but they have to see what Haiti's going to come up with before they move, the Americans. And move they will not. I mean, they're not about to intervene.
Well, Amy Wilentz, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome, Ian. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Amy Willensis, an award-winning writer whose books include The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and The Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now, awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship in General Nonfiction in 2020. She's the former Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker and a longtime contributing editor to The Nation and teaches at the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. And the latest book is Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. And she has an article at The Nation, Haiti Has Been Abandoned by the Media, the U.S., and the World. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a new religious movement, Christians Against Christian Nationalism, that was propelled by the January 6th storming of the Capitol, in which Christian symbols were mixed with white supremacist signs and Confederate flags.
Soldier of the cross, soldier of the cross, you carry the sword of faith. Soldier of the cross, soldier of the cross, you bring love to those who hate. You bring love to those who hate.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amanda Tyler, the Executive Director of Christians Against Christian Nationalism, a member of the Texas and the United States Supreme Court Bar. She has worked in Congress in a private legal practice and has served as a law clerk for a federal judge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amanda Tyler.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Amanda. And I take it that you, along with your colleagues at the Vote for the Common Good, who have partnered with Christians Against Christian Nationalism, launching a new curriculum aimed at confronting Christian nationalism in churches around the country, that in many ways is what happened 6 months ago with the storming of the Capitol, where we all saw what happened, even though there's an effort underway to kind of gaslight us all and tell us that what we saw with our own eyes didn't actually happen. But I certainly saw a lot of crosses and Christian symbolism amongst the Confederate flags and the Trump banners. And is that what got you motivated to be more active in your efforts?
Well, the January 6th insurrection certainly set off alarms for all of us who had grave concerns already about Christian nationalism. And fortunately, because we at Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty and the other organizations that joined together to form Christians Against Christian Nationalism, we had a platform and resources and email list already ready to go to give people resources to help understand Christian nationalism when it happened on January 6th. And one thing, although it is certainly incredibly concerning to see all of the symbols of Christian nationalism on display at the Capitol on January 6th, we have to not think that Christian nationalism only shows up in such overt and dramatic instances. Christian nationalism is an ideology that divides us as Americans. It's one that threatens the Christian faith, and it's one that's been part of the American experience now for centuries. And so we have to look for those instances of Christian nationalism being really entrenched in our institutions and our congregations and our churches, and to help understand and root those out before they rise to a dramatic and violent level like they did at the Capitol on January 6th.
So just to get an understanding of the theology, if that's too kind a description, of Christian nationalism, I guess it's obviously different from dominionists, like, for example, Senator Ted Cruz's father, who want, they're theocrats, they want to make the Lord Jesus the head of state. Christian nationalists, I don't know whether they want religious leaders in government and in the White House, but in many ways, my understanding is the excuses that have been made for Trump being a libertine and all the women, etc., that have come out accusing him of sexual assaults, etc., that the rationalization has been about King Cyrus in the Bible. So give me a sense of what is the theology behind Christian nationalism. How do they equate support for Trump with the Bible, which frankly was not about certainly if you read the Beatitudes, etc., it's not about supporting billionaires and assault rifles and all the other agenda that seems to be the obsession of the Christian right.
Right. I think you're exactly right. And that's because Christian nationalism is not a religion. It is a political ideology and a cultural framework that tries to merge our identities as Americans and Christians. And it is directly at odds with our country's commitment to religious liberty that says we are all equal citizens without regard to religion. It's also directly at odds with the foundations of the Christian faith. That declares that Jesus Christ is Lord, not any political leader. And I think it's exactly because of this ideology that so many Christians are deeply concerned about Christian nationalism. At the same time, we have to admit Christian nationalism uses Christian imagery and Christian symbols to try to make legitimate its claims for political power. And in some communities, Christianity has been so deformed by Christian nationalism that it's hard to tell the difference between the two. And so I think that a broad cross-section of Christians across the theological spectrum has become really concerned about what Christian nationalism has done to twist the theology of Christianity. And that's what they are trying to reclaim in trying to better understand what Christian nationalism is, trying to recognize how it shows up in our society and in our churches, and how to root it out from our congregations. And that's the work of Christians Against Christian Nationalism, and specifically this new curriculum that is coming out this week that can be used by church communities to discuss Christian nationalism, discuss biblical responses to it, and actions that they as communities might take to take a stand against Christian nationalism.
And how does Christian nationalism tie in with white supremacy?
Well, the way that we talk about it in the Christians Against Christian Nationalism initiative is that Christian nationalism often overlaps with and provides cover for white supremacy and racial subjugation. And, you know, Christian nationalism relies so heavily on a mythological founding of the United States as a, quote, Christian nation, one founded by Christians in order to privilege Christianity. And of course, inherent in that idea and in that statement is a white Christian American, because of the history of this country, and which was founded with slavery in, you know, a part of the American experience. And so in many ways, I believe that Christian nationalism cannot be understood distinct from exploration of racism in this country and white supremacy. But often, you know, it provides cover for sometimes the racism is blatant and sometimes it's latent. And that's because there's almost a code word when you talk about a Christian America that talks about a white Christian America, hearkening back again to this mythological founding that was made as if the country was made exclusively for white Christians. And so I believe that's why one lesson in this curriculum is devoted to Christian nationalism, white supremacy, and racism as a way for congregations to have that really vital conversation as they're talking about Christian nationalism.
So is it also a part of your curriculum re-educating Christian nationalists about the Constitution, in particular the Founding Fathers, who were all extremely well aware of the horrible religious wars that had taken place in Europe, and also much of the religious oppression that took place with the witch burning, etc., and one of the intellectual spark of the American Revolution, Tom Paine, once wrote that belief in a cruel God makes a cruel man?
Well, we certainly, you know, have discussion questions that could lead communities to have conversations about those things, because the Christians Against Christian Nationalism project reminds those of us who are engaging on this topic about some of the foundations of of the foundational principles of religious freedom for all, principles like people of all faiths and none have a right and responsibility to engage in the public square, principles that the country was founded on the principle that the government would remain neutral when it comes to religion, that no one's citizenship would be contingent upon their religious beliefs or even if they had religious beliefs. So reminding people of these basic principles of American constitutional government, the principles of the separation of the institutions of religion and government and how that supports religious freedom for all, these all go directly against many of the tenets of Christian nationalism that argue for a privileged place for Christianity in American government. So that idea is against the very foundations of the constitutional support for religious freedom for all. And so, yes, our project, our curriculum reminds people about those basics of constitutional law in American history and hope that people will have conversations in their communities that really question a lot of the myths that underlie Christian nationalism. I think that's one reason the ideology has become so entrenched in our society is because some of these claims of Christian nationalism go unanswered. And so both with the curriculum and some of the other resources that we have at ChristiansAgainstChristianNationalism.org, like myth-busting ideas, these are things that people can use in their communities and their social media feeds to help counteract the myths and the untruths of Christian nationalism.
Well, of course, the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution said Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So inasmuch as we have freedom to practice our faith without government interference, the government is also not able or is banned from or barred from imposing religious beliefs on the public. So it's the latter part that seems to have been lost. And I know every time there are lawsuits against prayer in school, etc., you find that argument come up. How do you deal with that, which is often sensitive to Christians who feel beleaguered? I mean, Rush Limbaugh's brother wrote a book about how Christians are oppressed in this country, which is something I don't notice, but maybe a lot of Christians feel oppressed. So is there any way to sort of expose that, indeed, if it's a fallacy, which it appears to be?
Yes, and that's the centerpiece of the work that the organization that I lead, Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, that's what we do. We are a faith-based group from the Baptist perspective that advocates for religious freedom for all and for the separation of church and state. And so we, for 85 years, have been making the argument that supports and that's founded on the First Amendment that a government that remains neutral when it comes to religion, that helps support everyone's religious freedom, including those of us in the majority, especially those of us in the majority, but also our friends who are from other religious practices and those who don't claim a religious practice at all. And so I believe that it's important. And, you know, there are many other faith-based groups and religious groups that also advocate with us. We work in coalition with them, that those of us who come from a religious perspective have a special responsibility, I think, to engage in the public square, but to do so respectfully and to understand that if we had a government that was promoting our religion in any way, that would actually hurt our religious freedom. It's unfortunately an idea that some people find counterintuitive. And so it's the role of groups like BJC and groups like Christians Against Christian Nationalism to remind everyone of these principles and to provide resources to help them have conversations with those in their communities to remind them how our system has worked very well for people of all faiths and none for centuries. There's no reason for us to change that constitutional system now, and we need to stand firmly against Christian nationalism, which would try to do exactly that.
So there's a very talented
artist here in Los Angeles, Erica Rothenberg, who's done an art piece that, you know, in front of churches, you have those notice boards that are sort of in a glass case with white letters on a black sort of velvet field. And it says Monday, homeless soup kitchen, Tuesday, battered wives meeting, Wednesday, Alcoholics Anonymous, Thursday, opioid victims, Friday, soup kitchen for the homeless, etc. And then on Sunday, the sermon, America is the greatest country on earth. So I know that's done as an irony, but what can be done to kind of take back the Bible from those who've confiscated it in a way for the ends of Christian nationalism? And the prophet Jesus, is any cursory reading of the New Testament would indicate he had nothing like the values that Christian nationalists have. I mean, he didn't hate homosexuals. He didn't fly around in private jets shaking the poor people down for money on television. You know, he didn't carry an assault rifle. All of those sort of touchstones are the opposite of this prophet who ministered to the poor.
Yeah. When you were describing that, you know, message board outside of the church, I immediately thought just this past Sunday was July 4th, and we saw all kinds of expressions of American patriotism take over the worship hour in churches. And I preached at a church that did not do that this Sunday. And when I talked about how it was really important that we can be patriots, but without becoming cheerleaders for the American country, especially in our houses of worship, because when we do that, then we, as a well-known Christian theologian, Walter Brueggemann, has said, you know, we have a very, it would be too easy for us to be talked out of the critical edge of the gospel. And what he was talking about in that instance was, you know, this very idea that we are here in many ways to be critical of the state, that if we get too cozy with the state, we can be used as political pawns by those in power in ways that really jeopardize our theological convictions. And, you know, if that's the quickest way that you can tell the difference between patriotism and nationalism. Patriotism is a love of country. Nationalism is an allegiance to country that demands some kind of superiority over all of our other convictions, including our theological convictions. And when we go into that direction, we really are at risk of sacrificing our faith in terms of allegiance to the state. And that is really dangerous place for Christians to find themselves in.
Well, Amanda Tyler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Amanda Tyler, who's the Executive Director of Christians Against Christian Nationalism. She's a member of the Texas and United States Supreme Court Bar and has worked in Congress and in a private legal practice and has served as a law clerk for a federal judge. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down.